Dragons are at the heart of Middle-earth history, from Glaurung, the first dragon, to Smaug the Great, and beyond. Tolkien says that dragons survived deep into the Fourth Age. Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. On this channel, we dive deep into The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's wider legendarium, as well as A Song of Ice and Fire and The Witcher. Welcome. This is a compilation of 6 previously published videos looking at Tolkien's dragons. I hope you enjoy it. Morgoth, the original big bad guy of Tolkien's legendarium, built much during his time in Middle-earth. But perhaps the things with the greatest longevity were the creatures he created. Orcs, dragons, and more. Let's take a look at Morgoth's creatures. Middle-earth is filled with dangerous creatures, some natural and some distinctly unnatural. But where did they come from? Obviously, many dangerous creatures are not evil per se, even in the darkest of times in Tolkien's world. Wolves, bears, and probably olifaunts alike are naturally occurring in Middle-earth. And though they may be used by evil forces for evil deeds, they themselves are not evil. Tolkien's world has one true god, Uru, Ilúvatar, who is perfectly good, and also the only being capable of wielding the Flame Imperishable. In other words, the only thing capable of creating something out of nothing. Which means two very important things in Tolkien's theology. First, nothing that exists is 100% evil, because everything that exists ultimately comes from Eru. Nothing is, in Tolkien's words, irredeemable. And second, when we talk about Morgoth's creations, they are sub-creations, really, made using substances that Eru had already made. So the natural creatures that exist in Middle-earth, wolves, bears and so on, are not evil per se, but can be used for evil. Those that were subcreated by Morgoth for evil purposes are still not irredeemable, even if in the vast majority of cases they stay doing mostly evil stuff all of their days. Those may sound like rather technical points, but Tolkien felt they were pretty fundamental. Okay, that said, what did Morgoth make? Well, let's start with orcs, as they were the first of his sub-creations to take shape, even before the First Age. We read this in the Silmarillion about their origins. The context here is the fate of a significant number of elves that were captured in the early days by Morgoth, known then as Melkor. But of those unhappy ones who were ensnared by Melkor, little is known of a certainty. For who of the living has descended into the pits of Utumno, or has explored the darkness of the councils of Melkor? Yet this is held true by the wise of Eresea, that all those of the Quendi who come into the hands of Melkor ere Utumno was broken were put there in prison, and by slow arts of cruelty were corrupted and enslaved. And thus did Melkor breed the hideous race of the orcs in envy and mockery of the elves, of whom they were afterwards the bitterest foes. For the orcs had life and multiplied after the manner of the children of Ilúvatar, and naught that had life of its own, nor the semblance of life, could ever Melkor make since his rebellion in the Ainulindale before the beginning, so say the wise. And deep in their dark hearts, the orcs loathed the master whom they served in fear, the maker only of their misery. This, it may be, was the vilest deed of Melkor, and the most hateful to Ilúvatar. It has to be said that Tolkien went through a few different variants of thought on the exact nature of orcs. I did a whole other video on it if you're interested. But he never varied from the concept that they were originally created by Morgoth as foot soldiers for himself and as a mockery of the elves, who were the firstborn children of Ilúvatar. The orcs are therefore a twisted version of his own firstborn children. Not that those children loved him, of course. In fact, they hated him, a state of being that was sustained from generation to generation, because yes, orcs multiplied after the manner of the children of Ilúvatar. They had babies. Much, much later, Uruk-hai emerge as stronger, tougher orcs, better able to operate during daylight. These again were not made ex nihilo, from nothing, but by, well, Treebeard speculates that it is a mark of evil things that came in the great darkness that they cannot abide the sun, but Saruman's orcs can endure it, even if they hate it. I wonder what he has done. Are they men he has ruined, or has he blended the races of orcs and men? That would be a black evil. Treebeard is probably right in both his speculation as to how Sauron, then Saruman, made the Uruk-hai, and the moral implications. Anyway, the second clear sub-created creature from Morgoth is dragons. The first dragon was named Glaurung. We read that Morgoth perceived now that the orcs, unaided, were no match for the Noldor, and he sought in his heart for new counsel. Again, after 100 years, Glaurung, the first of the Uruk-hai, the fire drakes of the north, issued from Angband's gates by night. He was yet young and scarce half-grown, for long and slow is the life of dragons. But the elves fled before him to Ered Wethrin and Dothonion in dismay, and he defiled the fields of Ardgallan. But Morgoth was ill-pleased that Glaurung had disclosed himself oversoon, and after his defeat there was the long peace of well-nigh 200 years. Glaurung was an early, powerful prototype for the later winged dragons, which emerged at the very end of the First Age, and some escaped to multiply in the manner of the children of Ilúvatar through the second, third, and even later ages, though they seem to have shrunk in size and power over the ages. Smaug was probably the last of the great dragons. So we have orcs and dragons, both confirmed within the pages of the Silmarillion as having been Morgoths. But there is more, because we get trolls. Trolls appear dotted about the pages of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And although we don't get absolute confirmation, Treebeard, an ancient and wise observer of events, opines that trolls are only counterfeits made by the enemy in the great darkness, in mockery of Ents, as orcs were of elves. So that's another mockery of something good made by Morgoth. As I said, Tolkien never, however, fully confirms it, and gives a rather vague answer to a question about it in his letter 153. I am not sure about trolls. I think they are mere counterfeits, and hence, though here I am of course only using elements of old barbarous myth-making that had no aware metaphysic, they return to mere stone images when not in the dark. But there are other sorts of trolls, besides these rather ridiculous if brutal stone trolls, for which other origins are suggested. So maybe not all trolls, but I think we have enough here to start to pull together some commonalities. First, none of these creatures are really new or original. Orcs and probably trolls are clearly created in an effort to mock Eru's true original creations. Some have suggested, though the evidence is not exactly strong, that the same might be the case for dragons, as mockeries of the great eagles. Also, it's fair to say that the counterfeits are never as beautiful or clever or impressive as the original. That Treebeard quote we looked at a moment ago actually carries on. He says that trolls are just mockeries of Ents, then affirms that we are stronger than trolls. We are made of the bones of the earth. We can split stone like the roots of trees, only quicker, far quicker, if our minds are roused. If we are not hewn down or destroyed by fire or blast of sorcery, we could split Isengard into splinters and crack its walls into rubble. As we discover, these are not idle boasts, and elves could probably say the same about orcs. The power and craftsmanship of any given elf far outstrips that of any given orc. Which isn't to say that Morgoth couldn't create powerful things. Glaurung was immensely powerful, as was Ancalagon, and there's also Karcharoth. Karcharoth was a werewolf, so descended from the line of werewolves originally created by Sauron. Yes, Sauron also took raw materials from elsewhere, this time presumably wolves and humans, and turned them into something twisted and under his control. Karcharoth, though, was Morgoth perfecting that prototype. It's a long story, and a great one. Please do check out Beren and Lúthien if you never have. But Morgoth discovered that Húan, the bestest boy in Middle-earth and a legendary figure in his own right, might be about to attack his stronghold with Beren and Lúthien. There was a legend or prophecy that Húan could only be killed by the greatest wolf to ever have lived, so Morgoth set himself to create just that, to guard his gate. The heroes in this get past Karcharoth on the way in, with the help of Lúthien's magic, but not on the way out. A long chase ensues, and it all ends up with Karcharoth killing Huan and Beren, but himself dying. So although this isn't the moral most people take from the story, it does prove that Morgoth did make the greatest wolf ever to live, because Karcharoth killed Huan. So Morgoth could create powerful beings, but not original ones. And perhaps the fact that these are all imitations is actually a compliment to Eru from Morgoth, though no doubt unintended. He wanted soldiers, and so he created something like the elves. He wanted something tougher and stronger, so he made something like the Ents. Sometimes he could make very impressive things indeed, but he could never truly capture the beauty of the original. It is often misquoted, but Frodo sums this up well in The Lord of the Rings when talking about orcs. The shadow that bred them can only mock. It cannot make, not real new things of its own. I don't think it gave life to the orcs. It only ruined them and twisted them. And if they are to live at all, they have to live like other living creatures. All of which brings us back to that imperishable flame, the power through which Iluvatar creates things from nothing. Because Morgoth really, really wanted to create things of his own. We read early on in the Silmarillion that he had gone often alone into the void places seeking the imperishable flame, for desire grew hot within him to bring into being things of his own, and it seemed to him that Iluvatar took no thought for the void, and he was impatient of its emptiness. Yet he found not the fire, for it is with Iluvatar. But being alone, he had begun to conceive thoughts of his own unlike those of his brethren. Thoughts of power and glory of his own, which is where our last important distinction lies. Wanting to create things on his own was not Morgoth's sin. It was wanting to do it for his own glory and power. It was not wrong for Morgoth to want to create things using what Iluvatar had already created. It was wrong of him to do it as a mockery or a counterfeit. Tolkien viewed himself as a sub-creator, and indeed anyone who ever creates is too, whether that act of creation is a work of art, another human, or a nice garden. Morgoth's creations were evil not because the act of sub-creation was evil, but because the intent was. How powerful was Glaurung, Morgoth's first and mightiest dragon? Let's take a look. Morgoth seems to have first thought to make dragons early in the First Age of Middle-earth. The situation was that after he had arrived back in Middle-earth with the Silmarils at the start of the First Age, he was followed by the Noldor elves, headed up by Feanor, who wanted his Silmarils back. Those Noldor, fresh from the Undying Lands, were very strong, and Morgoth relatively weak, so for the first while Morgoth was penned in to Angband, his fortress in the north of Middle-earth. There were a few epic battles, but essentially there was a long standoff, the Siege of Angband. The elves weren't strong enough to take on Morgoth in his own fortress, and he wasn't strong enough to break out from their siege. After a failed attempt to break the siege in the year 155, we read this in The War of the Jewels. Thereafter, there was peace for many years and no open assault, for Morgoth perceived now that the orcs unaided were no match for the Noldor, save in such numbers as he could not yet muster. Therefore, he sought in his heart for new counsel, and he bethought him of dragons. Which seems to have kept him busy for a few decades, until in the year 260, when Glaurung emerged, albeit only briefly. We pick up the story in the Silmarillion. After 100 years, Glaurung, the first of the Ur-Uluki, the Fire Drakes of the North, issued from Angband's gates by night. He was yet young and scarce half-grown, for long and slow is the life of dragons. But the elves fled before him to Ered Wethrin and Dothonion in dismay, and he defiled the fields of Ardgallen. Then Fingon, prince of Hithlum, rode against him with archers on horseback and hemmed him round with a ring of swift riders, and Glaurung could not endure their darts, being not yet come to his full armour, and he fled back to Angband, and came not forth again for many years. Fingon won great praise, and the Noldor rejoiced, for few foresaw the full meaning and threat of this new thing. But Morgoth was ill-pleased that Glaurung had disclosed himself over soon, and after his defeat there was the long peace of well-nigh 200 years.
So Morgoth had spent some time making Glaurung, the first dragon, who got a bit of a rush of blood to the head and charged out of Angband before he was fully grown. And Morgoth wasn't pleased and kept him penned into Angband for another couple of hundred years or so until he was ready. At which point, we should cover off the important point that although I talk about Morgoth making Glaurung, he didn't craft him out of nothing. Only Eru Ilúvatar can do that in Tolkien's world. He would have had to start with some raw materials and gone from there. Some have speculated that in the same way that orcs are a mockery of elves, dragons are a mockery of the great eagles, or a counterfeit, which was the word Tolkien preferred. Perhaps, though we don't have confirmation of this. And although later dragons were clearly flying creatures, Glaurung was not. Not that that should make us view him as anything less than hugely powerful. By the time of his next emergence into the world in the year 455 for the Dagor Bragollach, the Battle of Sudden Flame, where Morgoth's forces broke out unexpectedly and in great force, his entrance there was quite something. In the front of that fire came Glaurung the Golden, father of dragons, in his full might, and in his train were Balrogs, and behind them came the black armies of the orcs, in multitudes such as the Noldor had never before seen or imagined. And they assaulted the fortresses of the Noldor, and broke the leaguer about Angband, and slew wherever they found them the Noldor and their allies, grey elves and men. Many of the stoutest of the foes of Morgoth were destroyed in the first days of that war, bewildered and dispersed, and unable to muster their strength. Glaurung the Golden was the head of a massive army, with Balrogs as his support act. Reading on, his personal impact is clear. The strength and terror of the Great Worm were now great indeed, and elves and men withered before him. It appeared that no single opponent could stand before him, and if we're talking about power, then he had that in abundance. Hugely strong, he used his tail and weight to his advantage, crushing opponents. He could breathe fire, and his armour was massively strong, except in one place. We'll obviously come back to that. At one point, he even threw up a vast vapour and foul reek that scattered his opponents. Later, we learn that his blood was so noxious that it could render even strong men unconscious. All but the greatest heroes of the age withered before him. And it wasn't just the physical power that set him apart from the rest of Morgoth's forces. There was his ability to hypnotise and control his opponents. Witness this moment when he manages to stop the mighty Turin mid-attack just by catching his eye with his magnetic gaze. Then Turin sprang about and strode against him, and the edges of Gurthang shone as with flame. But Glaurung withheld his blast and opened wide his serpent eyes and gazed upon Turin. Without fear, Turin looked into them as he raised up the sword, and straight away he fell under the binding spell of the lidless eyes of the dragon, and was halted, moveless. Then, for a long time, he stood as one graven of stone, and they two were alone, silent before the doors of Nargothrond. Glaurung's control here is so complete that Turin loses all awareness of what is going on around him, orcs swarming past, the cries of their captives. Instead, Glaurung speaks honeyed words, making Turin hate himself and influencing him to retreat and go to a completely different part of Middle-earth, seeking his family. And Turin, being under the spell of Glaurung, hearkened to his words, and he saw himself in a mirror misshapen by malice, and loathed that which he saw. Then Turin, being yet bemused by the eyes of the dragon, as were he treating with a foe that could no pity, believed the words of Glaurung, and turning away, he sped over the bridge. This is impressive and a worrying level of control over a strong-minded man. Glaurung then later performs a similar trick against Nienor, Turin's sister, but this time he doesn't just freeze her and suggest she do something, he completely wipes her memory of everything, including her own identity. Scary stuff. I won't go into the whole plot of Children of Hurin here, but Glaurung's manipulations were at the heart of it all, and it shows one other incredibly powerful aspect of Glaurung's armoury, his fearsome intellect. This isn't just a matter of him being quite clever. He had an innate understanding of motivations and desires and how to press the exact right buttons to make people do things they otherwise wouldn't do. This ability is so uncanny, reading The Children of Hurin often leads you to wonder whether Glaurung actually had the ability to see ahead in time. There's no real indication that he could. He was just that good at manipulation that things turned out the way he wanted. Not that it was perfect. There were some things he could not foresee, including his own doom, which came from Turin hiding in a chasm so he could stab up into Glaurung's soft underbelly. I said we would come back to that weakness in his armour. Still, even in his death, he forged the final link in the doom and tragedy of Turin and Nienor. Despite his huge impact there in the First Age, perhaps Glaurung's greatest contribution was his role as Father of Dragons. His brood was many and terrible, we're told. To be honest, Tolkien isn't 100% clear on whether this means the other dragons who followed him were his actual children. Some of them were, or none, and being their father was just an honorary title, as he was the first dragon. To be sure, the later dragons were different to Glaurung, and there appeared to be several different types of them, with the biggest innovation, if that's the right word, being winged dragons, revealed towards the end of the First Age. Morgoth, we read, loosed upon his foes the last desperate assault that he had prepared, and out of the pits of Angband there issued the winged dragons that had not before been seen. Personally, I suspect that Glaurung was the father of at least many of them. The dragons of the Second and Third Ages certainly seem to reproduce via eggs without Morgoth's intervention, and there are many shared attributes between him and his later descendants, suggesting a link. Take Smaug, for example. Tolkien describes them both as Uraloki, or fire drakes. They breathe fire, are intelligent, manipulative, like sleeping on mounds of gold, have hypnotic abilities and hard scales, though with a noticeable weakness in their soft underbelly. And Glaurung was the greater in all of those things, other than flying, of course. Smaug comes across as an evil echo of his formidable forebear. Glaurung was the first and greatest of the dragons, but still just a prototype. He crawled around the earth rather than flew over it, and maliciously manipulated rather than just destroyed. Morgoth's next step in the development of dragons would be Ancalagon the Black, but we'll look at him in another video. How powerful was Ancalagon the Black, the mightiest winged fire dragon ever? Was he just a big dragon, or was there more going on? Let's take a look. In a previous video, we looked at Glaurung the Golden, the first and mightiest of the dragons devised by Morgoth. But although he was definitely a dragon, Tolkien used the word Uruloki to describe him, which means fire drake, the same word he used for Smaug. Glaurung was missing one vital part of what we think of as what makes up a dragon. He didn't have wings. He was, to all intents and purposes, a prototype. He had astonishing powers, but Morgoth clearly thought he could do better, so he went back to the drawing board. As always, we should clarify that Morgoth here was not creating something out of nothing. Only Uru, the one true god of Tolkien's legendarium, could do that. He had to use existing materials and corrupt them or twist them in some way. That said, whatever he made Glaurung out of, it seems that the dragons that followed, his descendants, including Ancalagon, were more a matter of selective breeding. Glaurung was known as the Father of Dragons, so like orcs, who according to Tolkien, multiply after the manner of the children of Ilúvatar, we could theoretically trace the draconic line back through the ages to Glaurung. So yes, orc babies and yes, dragon babies. Glaurung's DNA was probably therefore mixed with something else and more than a pinch of dark magic to bring the wings. Think when Saruman and probably earlier Sauron seemingly mixed a little human DNA into their orcs to create Uruk-hai, orcs who, among other things, could operate in daylight. Without going through the entire history of the First Age, Glaurung first emerged in the year 260 and died in the year 499 when Morgoth's forces were slowly pressing their way across the continent, defeating foes everywhere. One elven or human stronghold fell after another. Glaurung fell, but he had been extraordinarily effective. This was an experiment worth repeating, and it appears that behind the scenes Morgoth had been doing just that. Not that we saw the result until the year 587 of the First Age, so nearly a century after Glaurung's demise. By then, things had changed dramatically in Middle-earth. Morgoth's seemingly inevitable conquest of the continent had been foiled. Eärendil's epic mission to seek out the aid of the Valar had resulted in the host of the Valar arriving in Middle-earth and driving Morgoth's forces all the way back to the gates of Angband, Morgoth's fortress. Things looked desperate for him. We read this in the Silmarillion. Then, seeing that his hosts were overthrown and his power dispersed, Morgoth quailed, and he dared not come forth himself. But he loosed upon his foes the last desperate assault that he had prepared, and out of the pits of Angband there issued the winged dragons that had not before been seen. And so sudden and ruinous was the onset of that dreadful fleet that the host of the Valar was driven back, for the coming of the dragons was with great thunder and lightning and a tempest of fire. We're talking about Ancalagon here, the greatest of that dreadful fleet, but it's clear that Morgoth released a lot of dragons at that time. Glaurung's impact was alone, albeit against weaker opposition than the host of the Valar, and without the support of great thunder and lightning and so on, whereas Ancalagon was one of many who had been unleashed at the same time to ruinous effect. Still, their impact was immense. The host of the Valar were pushed back until this happened. Eärendil came, shining with white flame, and about Vingolot were gathered all the great birds of heaven, and Throndor was their captain, and there was battle in the air all the day and through a dark night of doubt. Before the rising of the sun, Eärendil slew Ancalagon the Black, the mightiest of the dragon host, and cast him from the sky, and he fell upon the towers of Thangorodrim, and they were broken in his ruin. Then the sun rose, and the host of the Valar prevailed, and well nigh all the dragons were destroyed, and all the pits of Morgoth were broken and unroofed. We'll get back to what happened to the other dragons at another time, but Ancalagon was thrown down by an elf, so perhaps not that impressive. But we obviously need to think again, because Eärendil wasn't just an elf, but a legend in his own right. And he wasn't just standing around on the ground trying to get a lucky shot in on the dragon. He was in a flying ship with a Silmaril, and, well, this is the description. Fair and marvellous was that vessel made, and it was filled with a wavering flame, pure and bright, and Eärendil the mariner sat at the helm, glistening with dust of elven gems, and the Silmaril was bound upon his brow. Far he journeyed in that ship, even into the starless voids, but most often was he seen at morning or at evening, glimmering in sunrise or sunset, as he came back to Valinor from voyages beyond the confines of the world. Impressive stuff. He was literally a star come to earth. So instead of judging Ancalagon by who he was defeated by, let's first acknowledge that it was a close-run thing. There was a dark night of doubt for the forces of good, with an impressive foe. Then also that he was recognised as the mightiest of all the dragons in that host. And finally, his size, which is massive. Tolkien didn't tell us exactly how big Ancalagon was, and to be honest, he didn't tell us much about him full stop. We just read the only named reference to him in the Silmarillion, and he has just one other reference in The Lord of the Rings, which we'll get onto. But we do get a clue. When he was killed, he fell upon the towers of Thangorodrim, and they were broken in his ruin. We don't know how high he was falling from, or anything like that, so the idea of breaking some stonework doesn't tell us much, but we do know a bit about Thangorodrim. Tolkien tells us that its towers were the mightiest in Middle-earth, and could be beheld from far off. They were basically volcanoes into which Morgoth had burrowed his fortress, and we have, remarkably, a picture from Tolkien himself of Tol Sirion, which has them in the distance. He seems to have changed his mind on their position somewhat later, but if you take that at face value, as Karen Wynne Fonstad, the highly respected Tolkien scholar and cartographer did, you get the height of the tallest at about 35,000 feet, that's over 10 kilometres, with the base being 5 miles, about 8 kilometres wide. There were three of those towers, and Ancalagon's fall destroyed all of them. Are we really to believe that Ancalagon's wingspan was several miles wide? Personally, I don't think so. Perhaps Ancalagon's fall wiped out one of them, and that knocked over the other two. They were mighty, but they were also glorified volcanic slag heaps, so one falling could easily have set off a volcanic landslide eruption that took out the other two. But still, large enough to destroy a mountain? That's impressively large. I'll spare you the nerdy calculations, but Smaug was something over 20 metres long, Glaurung perhaps twice that, and Ancalagon clearly larger still. And he had wings, of course. Thorondor, the King of Eagles, who was also in that battle, had a wingspan of 55 metres, that's 180 feet. And it's not hard to imagine the biggest ever dragon being larger than the biggest ever eagle. This was an Age of Legends, remember. A literal star also fought in the battle. So Tolkien leaves it to our imagination, but there is little doubt that Ancalagon was enormous. And given that his predecessor Glaurung and descendant Smaug both had the usual array of dragony strengths, immensely strong scale armour, intelligence, a certain hypnotic charm, and fire-breathing, of course, he probably had them too. Actually, the fire-breathing is the thing that is also referenced in The Lord of the Rings. Gandalf says this to Frodo. It has been said that dragonfire could melt and consume the Rings of Power, but there is not now any dragon left on Earth in which the old fire is hot enough. Nor was there ever any dragon, not even Ancalagon the Black, who could have harmed the One Ring, the ruling ring, for that was made by Sauron himself. Not being able to breathe fire hot enough to destroy the One Ring is not a big indicator of weakness, but the fact that Gandalf chose Ancalagon as the example of the hottest dragonfire ever, not even Ancalagon the Black, he says, shows that Ancalagon, by reputation at least, breathed the fiercest flame, hotter even than Glaurung. It is noticeable also that Gandalf doesn't feel the need to explain to Frodo who Ancalagon was, which means that Ancalagon's legend had been passed down the millennia not just to the likes of Gandalf, who had lost most of his memories of life before his Third Age arrival in Middle-earth, but also to Frodo and the Hobbits. It's tempting to underrate the importance or power of Ancalagon, because he is only mentioned twice in the main books of the published legendarium, once in the Silmarillion and once in The Lord of the Rings, and both of those occasions could be interpreted as underwhelming. In the Silmarillion, he is named and vanquished in the same sentence, and in The Lord of the Rings, he is referenced only in the context of something he couldn't do, destroy the One Ring. But when you look at it the other way, he is only vanquished in a hard-fought battle against a bona fide legend with his Silmaril and hallowed flying ship, and it is made clear that Ancalagon is the greatest of the flying dragons ever. And when Gandalf says that he wouldn't have been able to destroy the One Ring, it's because it was a reasonable question to ask. Could the most powerful of flying dragons have been able to do it? It wasn't an obvious point. And his legend had survived for thousands of years. Ancalagon the Black was the mightiest of the flying dragons, and one of the mightiest creatures ever in Middle-earth. How powerful is Smaug? How much of a difference would he have made had he survived through to the War of the Ring? In The Hobbit, Smaug is presented as Smaug the Great, the most powerful and formidable opponent in the scope of the story. Yes, having read Tolkien's wider stories, we can appreciate the powers in the wider world, the threat of the necromancer that Gandalf heads off to deal with, the Balrog or other Maiar that may have given him a run for his money. But within the scope of the story itself, there is no doubt Smaug has no equals. He single-handedly destroys an entire dwarf kingdom dug into their mountain stronghold, as well as the thriving town of Dale, and is remembered a couple of centuries later in awe and fear. None have dared even approach the mountain since, let alone challenge him, despite the obvious massive hoard of gold he is lying on and him being quiet for so long. Dale was abandoned. Lake Town was built in a lake to protect it from potential fiery dragon attacks. The desolation of Smaug was left desolate. No one was willing to challenge him. Even the indomitable King Thorin struggled to find people willing to go with him on the quest of Erebor. Perhaps his worth can also be seen by how he is remembered, the monikers he is given. Bilbo is clearly trying to flatter Smaug to his face when he calls him Smaug the Chiefest and Greatest of Calamities, Lord Smaug the Impenetrable, and Smaug the Mighty. But out of his earshot, the dwarves call him Smaug the Dreadful, and Tolkien's introduction references Smaug the Magnificent. He was clearly thought of with awe by everyone. And yet, despite all this, Smaug was still felled by one arrow shot. In the movies, There's quite a backstory to this, with a series of special black arrows and a special bow, more a ballista, really, but in the book it was just one special black arrow aimed with precision at the weak spot in the hollow of Smaug's left breast. There was a hint of serendipity or magic to this, as the black arrow had been passed down from generation to generation, had never failed to hit its mark and had obviously always been recovered, and was thought to be forged by the true King Under the Mountain centuries earlier. Its final use would allow the new true King Under the Mountain to return. So although this may seem like a lucky shot, and Tolkien doesn't dwell on the mystical or fateful elements to what happened, it was not just luck, or even just a good archer with a good bow and some inside information on Smaug's weaknesses that felled the great dragon. It was fated to be, and shouldn't undermine our understanding of Smaug's strengths. And his strengths were many. He brags about it to Bilbo. "I kill where I wish, and none dare resist. I laid low the warriors of old, and their like is not in the world today. Then I was but young and tender. Now I am old and strong, 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 thief in the shadows," he gloated. "My armour is like tenfold shields. My teeth are swords, my claws spears. The shock of my tail a thunderbolt. My wings a hurricane, and my breath death. I am armoured above and below with iron scales and hard gems. No blade can pierce me." Smaug was bragging, but he was not wrong. We briefly see him in action above Lake Town later in the story, and no conventional weapons can harm him. Lake Town is burned and destroyed with a few fiery breaths and a lash of his tail. He had a weak spot, but if Bilbo hadn't spotted it, and the Thrush hadn't heard Bilbo tell the dwarves about it and then told Bard about it, and if Bard hadn't got that special arrow, nothing in Lake Town or the surrounding area would have been able to stop Smaug. He really was that impressive. And it's not as if Smaug is just a powerful, dumb animal. He is intelligent, able to read between the lines of what he learned from Bilbo to work out what was going on. The return of the dwarves, the involvement of Lake Town, and so on. His sense of smell was phenomenal. His sense in knowing that one cup was missing from his hoard, impressive. And his voice and eyes had hypnotic powers. How did he compare to the other impressive figures of the age? Well, we get an intriguing perspective from Unfinished Tales. In that, Gandalf talks about his reasons for supporting the quest of Erebor. Yes, he wanted to help the dwarves reclaim their homeland, but he had a bigger vision as well. He was thinking ahead to the inevitable final confrontation with Sauron and what his dark plans might be. "I thought then, and I am sure now, that to attack Lorien and Rivendell as soon as he was strong enough was his original plan. It would have been a much better plan for him, and much worse for us. You may think that Rivendell was out of his reach, but I did not think so. The state of things in the north was very bad. The kingdom under the mountain and the strong men of Dale were no more. To resist any force that Sauron might send to regain the northern passes in the mountains and the old lands of Angmar, there were only the dwarves of the Iron Hills, and behind them lay a desolation and a dragon. The dragon Sauron might use with terrible effect. Often I said to myself, I must find some means of dealing with Smaug." So Gandalf thought that Smaug, supported by Sauron's orcs, could perhaps destroy Lothlorien and Rivendell, even though they were protected by the magic of Galadriel and Elrond respectively. We saw orcs attack Lothlorien repeatedly in the War of the Ring and fail repeatedly. Smaug would have been the difference. I'm sure fire from above would have been particularly effective against those wood-loving elves. And so Gandalf was very happy to support Thorin in his attempt to take on Smaug. Eliminating Smaug, getting the dwarves back to the Lonely Mountain, and leaving the humans in that part of the world free from fear of dragon attack would dramatically change the geopolitical situation in that part of Middle-earth. Put simply, Gandalf thought that Smaug being alive or dead would be the difference in the Northern War during the War of the Ring. But if Smaug were so powerful and strategically important, did Gandalf really think that Thorin and his small company could defeat Smaug by themselves? That seems unlikely. In fact, he said, So it was that the quest of Erebor set out. I do not suppose that when it started, Thorin had any real hope of destroying Smaug. There was no hope. Yet it happened. Gandalf was instead relying not on the dwarves being more powerful than Smaug, they self-evidently were not, but that something would turn up. Or more accurately, he felt that if Bilbo went with them, they would succeed, and if he didn't, they would not. He was right, of course. Gandalf's ability to sense the future, even fuzzily, is crucial so often in these stories. So Smaug was the preeminent force in that part of Middle-earth. He may have been a notch down from the Maiar in terms of raw power, but it's clear that Sauron still treated Smaug differently to other people on his side, not as someone he could dominate and order to do something, but rather someone who shared his vision and could be trusted more like an actual ally. Smaug wasn't on Sauron's side, per se. They were more like natural allies. So less like the Nazgul and more like Shelob, for example. And Smaug was clearly also the preeminent dragon of his age, and the last great dragon. Gandalf tells Frodo later that now Smaug was gone, there were still dragons, but none so powerful. Before Smaug, however, there were many more dragons, and inarguably greater dragons. Perhaps I'll do a video on them sometime. We read of them in the Silmarillion. The first great dragon made by Morgoth was Glaurung, who had no wings but took on entire armies on his own, ruled as a dragon king, and his magic was great, wiping people's memories, weaving magical lies and deceits. He features heavily in the tragedy of the Children of Húrin. Then we have Ancalagon the Black, the great dragon of Morgoth. His flames were hotter than all others. He could fly, and when he fell to his ruin, he broke 3 mountains, such was his size. We don't have exact measurements for Smaug, or any of those other dragons, but it does seem that Smaug was much smaller, while still being pretty huge. Tolkien admitted that the famous picture he drew for the cover of The Hobbit makes Bilbo too big and Smaug too small, and in the text itself we're told that he was vast and his wings were immeasurable. He ate 6 ponies in one sitting, he said, which tells us how big his jaws and stomach were, at least. But even so, he seems much smaller than Ancalagon at his height. So, overall, how powerful was Smaug? He was less than his forebears, and not as great as certainly the strongest of the Maiar of his time, but was the last great dragon, and that makes him by a long way the most fearsome creature in that part of Middle-earth. Gandalf feared that, if he had a mind to, he could destroy Lothlorien and Rivendell, overcoming the magic of the Rings of Power held by Galadriel and Elrond. Sauron treated him as an ally, not a vassal, and the Free Peoples of Middle-earth didn't dare go near him. But he had a weakness. Yes, there was a physical weak spot there on his underbelly, but in truth his real weakness was his pride. He was clever enough to know that his underbelly was soft, and also clever enough to make for himself a new armour of precious stones pressed into his flesh over centuries lying on his hoard. But it was his pride that made him show this off to Bilbo. Flattered by Bilbo's grand words, stung by the accusation that he even had a weakness, he showed off. Bilbo saw the gap in the armour, Bard learned of it, and Smaug crashed to his death. Smaug was powerful, very, very powerful, but he is also a lesson in hubris. Pride comes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, quite literally in Smaug's case. How rich is Smaug? He lies atop a massive mound of gold, so very, but how rich? People have tried to work it out. Smaug clearly is rich, lying in Erebor on a mound of gold, as dragons are wont to do. In the Hobbit movies, it isn't so much of a mound of treasure as a small hill. Landslides, or gold slides, were a serious issue. So, how much was there? Well, this is how it is described when Bilbo first comes across it in The Hobbit. Beneath Smaug, under all his limbs and his huge coiled tail, and about him on all sides stretching away across the unseen floors, lay countless piles of precious things, gold wrought and unwrought, gems and jewels, and silver red-stained in the ruddy light. Smaug lay with wings folded like an immeasurable bat, turned partly on one side, so that the hobbit could see his underparts and his long, pale belly, crusted with gems and fragments of gold from his long lying on his costly bed. Behind him, where the walls were nearest, could dimly be seen coats of mail, helms and axes, swords and spears hanging, and there in rows stood great jars and vessels filled with a wealth that could not be guessed. To say that Bilbo's breath was taken away is no description at all. There are no words left to express his staggerment, since men changed the language that they learned of elves in the days when all the world was wonderful. Bilbo had heard tell and sing of dragon hordes before, but the splendour, the lust, the glory of such treasure had never yet come home to him. His heart was filled and pierced with enchantment and with the desire of dwarves, and he gazed motionless, almost forgetting the frightful guardian, at the gold beyond price and count. So, there were countless piles of precious things, wealth that could not be guessed, and gold beyond price and count. Tolkien clearly didn't want us to bother with counting it, just marvel at the sight. Not that that will stop us. Sorry, Professor. Well, first of all, what is it made up of, this mound of treasure? Well, a lot of gold, some of which was presumably coins, some fashioned into various items, and some seemingly just chunks of unwrought ore, plus silver, a whole load of presumably well-crafted weapons and armour, gems and jewels aplenty, and most valuable of all, the Arkenstone, which was apparently worth 1/14 of the whole hoard, despite being small enough for Bilbo to easily hide upon his person. This was the treasure of the Kingdom of Erebor, plus whatever there was in the town of Dale, and maybe some trinkets Smaug had picked up from elsewhere. And Erebor was rich. Thorin describes his ancestors as being immensely rich and famous. The people of Lake Town seemed to have a saying that the king beneath the mountain, his wealth is like the sun, his silver like a fountain, his rivers golden run, the river is running gold from the mountain. Which is clearly poetic language, but makes the point. There was a lot of gold in Erebor, and Smaug took it all. So let's get two quick caveats out of the way before we get to the actual counting. First, no, Smaug isn't about to pop into a local shop and use any of his gold to buy some groceries or invest in something. So this is all just theoretical value. Its value to Smaug will be different to the value we might place on it in a very real sense. Not as a medium of exchange, but as a shiny bed. Dragons are different. And second, we do need to apply the basic economic principle of scarcity here. The value of all that gold was in it being hoarded rather than flooding the market. If there were enough gold out there for everyone to have some, its value would be much diminished. Oh, and rather obviously, trying to put a dollar value on Middle-earth gold is ridiculous for all the reasons you already know. None of which, or the fact that we don't have a definitive description of the size of the hoard or a full breakdown of its contents, has deterred people from trying to work it out. And as our starting point, we have the text and this picture Tolkien himself drew of Bilbo, Smaug and the gold. Michael Noah of Forbes magazine back in 2012 did Aru's own good work in taking that picture, estimating the size of the mound based on its relative length and breadth compared to Smaug and height compared to Bilbo, assuming 30% air holes in the hoard and a 50-50 gold-silver split, and reached a figure of $14.7 billion for the mound of gold and silver. Adding in an additional $29.4 billion for a number of outer mounds of treasure, the countless piles of precious things that Tolkien mentioned, $3.9 billion for the diamonds embedded in Smaug's belly, a generous $8 billion for even more diamonds and jewels, $1.1 billion on the various arms and armour, basing that on an assessment of the value of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's collection, another $500 million for unseen things in other rooms, and taking account of the Arkenstone as a separate item worth 1/14 of the total, so $4.4 billion, that came to a total of $62 billion. I've put a link in the description if you're interested, and please accept this as my hat tip for that great work. Others have come to other similar conclusions. I've seen several estimates in the tens of billions. Estimates based on the Hobbit movies are much higher, into the trillions, because there is a lot more gold there. Now, as much as I applaud these efforts, there is always room for a nerdy nitpick. First, Obviously, the price of gold and silver and diamonds has shifted a lot since 2012. At the time of writing this video, in real terms, diamonds are probably actually a bit cheaper than then. But silver is nearly twice as valuable and gold nearly three times. And I have an even more nerdy nitpick. In basing the calculation of the height of the biggest mound on that picture, we have to acknowledge that Tolkien stated later, in a letter, that Bilbo there is, and I quote, enormously too large, as he is really in a separate picture or plane, being invisible to the dragon. Your guess is as good as mine as to what scale enormously too large is, but it doesn't seem unreasonable to, say, double our estimation of the height of the main hoard, as well as at least doubling the value of the gold and silver in it in aggregate. I'll let you do your own detailed calculations if you wish, with whatever assumptions you like, but I came out to a figure easily in nine figures, which is an astonishing figure. But I want to suggest to you that the even more astonishing thing is that that probably still didn't make him the richest being in Middle-earth. And that's because Smaug's net worth is mostly in gold, silver, diamonds, and precious gems and jewels. But in Middle-earth, we have one other substance that is far, far more valuable than even gold. Mithril. Gandalf explains while the Fellowship is passing through Moria. The wealth of Moria was not in gold and jewels, the toys of the dwarves, nor in iron, their servant. Such things they found here, it is true, especially iron, but they did not need to delve for them. All things that they desired they could obtain in traffic, for here alone in the world was found Moria silver, or true silver, as some have called it. Mithril is the elvish name. The dwarves have a name which they do not tell. Its worth was 10 times that of gold, and now it is beyond price, for little is left above ground. So, while Mithril was being mined, it was already worth 10 times that of gold. In Smaug's time, it was worth immeasurably more. Again, this is to do with scarcity. As Gandalf says, there is little left above ground. The shift obviously came when Durin's folk were driven from Khazad-dûm by Durin's Bane. The survivors presumably managed to take some mithril with them, perhaps what they could carry, but the majority stayed in Moria. We'll come back to that in a moment. The Longbeard royalty settled in Erebor, so presumably any mithril they did have went with them, but then they went up to the Grey Mountains, where they were driven out by another dragon. Some went to the Iron Hills, and some went back to Erebor, but then Erebor itself was attacked by Smaug. It wasn't a good time for the dwarves. But as far as the mithril went, it meant that any they had managed to salvage from Khazad-dûm was probably all over the place. Maybe some survived through to Thorin and Co., though we don't hear of it. Perhaps some was taken by that dragon in the Grey Mountains. Perhaps some went to the Iron Hills. Smaug definitely took at least one piece, though probably not much more, else we would have heard of it. That one piece of mithril in Smaug's hoard was the mail shirt that Bilbo got, and that was worth a lot. This is Gandalf and Gimli discussing it. Bilbo had a corslet of mithril rings that Thorin gave him. I wonder what has become of it. Gathering dust still in Mitchell Delving Mavham House, I suppose. What? Cried Gimli, startled out of his silence. A corslet of Moria silver? That was a kingly gift. Yes, said Gandalf. I never told him, but its worth was greater than the value of the whole shire and everything in it. Whether Gandalf is being serious about being worth the value of the shire and everything in it is unclear, but Gimli's shock is not. If Gandalf is being remotely serious, he's suggesting that one hobbit or child-sized mithril shirt, small and light enough to be worn under travel clothes without anyone noticing, was worth, colloquially at least, 18,000 square miles of prime arable land, and all the mills and residential property and private property inside it. That mail shirt would be worth itemising in Smaug's hoard on its own. But as far as we're concerned, the bigger issue is whether any one individual had a significant amount of mithril. Because if they had, that would instantly make them even richer than Smaug. So, what happened to all the mithril of Khazad-dûm? Well, some was sold or gifted out or used during the golden era of Khazad-dûm. We hear of some helmets in Minas Tirith, Galadriel's ring, the moon letters appearing on the door of Durin, and so on. And as we noted, some was surely taken out by the retreating dwarves and ended up with dragons or in the Iron Hills or wherever. But the vast bulk of it, that remained in Khazad-dûm. And Gandalf tells us what happened to that. Of what they, the dwarves, brought to light, the orcs have gathered nearly all and given it in tribute to Sauron, who covets it. So the orcs gathered nearly all of the Mithril, and now Sauron has it. What is he hoarding it for? Well, I did a separate video on that, if you're interested. But when you add all that to the tributes he also gathers from other vassal lands, the rich mineral deposits of northern Mordor and so on, I think it becomes apparent that he is a different level rich. So, how rich was Smaug? If you do the maths, you can easily get to a number of tens of billions of dollars in today's money, or even hundreds of billion dollars, so very, very rich. Not that he would ever spend any of it. But far from being the richest character in fantasy fiction, he's not even the richest character in Middle-earth. That's Sauron, and it's not even close. What happened to the dragons of Middle-earth? We obviously know about Smaug, but he wasn't the only one. What happened to the rest? Did they survive the Third Age? Let's take a look. I've looked in previous videos at some of the most powerful dragons Middle-earth has ever known, Glaurung, Ancalagon, and Smaug, and at the origin of dragons as a whole. For they are one of Morgoth's creations. No, they weren't created out of nothing, but they were created and refined by Morgoth in his dark laboratories. Glaurung was the first, and introduced himself to the world before Morgoth ideally wanted him to, but by the time of the fall of Gondolin there were many more. We read of dragons of the brood of Glaurung, and they were become now many and terrible. Years later, in the War of Roth, there were even more, and of an upgraded type. Morgoth loosed upon his foes the last desperate assault that he had prepared, and out of the pits of Angband there issued the winged dragons that had not before been seen, and so sudden and ruinous was the onset of that dreadful fleet that the host of the Valar was driven back, for the coming of the dragons was with great thunder and lightning and a tempest of fire. It must have been a terrible moment, but it was short-lived, for the host of the Valar were there, and they prevailed. It was actually Earendil who slew Ancalagon the Black, but well-nigh all the dragons were destroyed. Well-nigh obviously means nearly all, so some survived. An early draft has the number as low as 2, though it may have been a bit more than that. So dragons were nearly made extinct at the end of the First Age, and whatever was left of them found a new home somewhere far away to hide and recuperate. It wasn't just the dragons who did that, remember. Sauron did too, and some orcs, and at least one Balrog. Dragons are not invincible, so steering clear of the mighty who lingered into the Second Age is only sensible. The new home they found for themselves was the Northern Waste, that icy cold land north of the Grey Mountains, and perhaps a bit later, the Withered Heath, which is a long, thin valley between the two ranges of the Grey Mountains. Gandalf actually makes a throwaway remark about this in The Hobbit, saying, "I know where Mirkwood is, and the Withered Heath where the great dragons bred." So the dragons bred there, and they were still considered great dragons. It was probably not somewhere you would wish to visit. But slowly the free peoples started to populate neighbouring areas and the dragons multiplied. And you know what dragons are like when they start to smell gold. The dwarves probably experienced it the worst, probably because they had a lot of gold. We read this about Thorin the First, who is the great-great-great-great-grandfather of the Thorin we know, if I've got my number of greats right. Thorin the First removed and went into the far north to the Grey Mountains, where most of Durin's folk were now gathering, for those mountains were rich and little explored. But there were dragons in the wastes beyond, and after many years they became strong again and multiplied, and they made war on the dwarves and plundered their works. At last, Dain the First, together with Thror, his second son, was slain at the doors of his hall by a great Coldrake. Not long after, most of Durin's folk abandoned the Grey Mountains. So the dragons made war on the dwarves, and eventually drove them out of the Grey Mountains. Presumably, it is around this time that dragons consumed 4 of the 7 rings of power the dwarf lords had, as we're told that they did. It wasn't just the dwarves who came into contact with the dragons, though. In 1954, while putting the finishing touches to The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien wrote a poem called Scather the Worm. Here's an extract with a description of Scather, comparing him to other dragons. Some have great wings like the wind, some have fire and fierce wrath, some have venom on their long teeth, some have hides like armour, tails like steel, tongues like spears, eyes piercing bright, some are great and golden, some are green, some are red as glowing iron. Not so was Scather. He crawled like a slow creeping death, too horrible to flee from, froze men with fear and his icy breath, and then crushed them, ground them under his long white belly. The poem goes on to describe how Scather was killed by Fram of the Eothiod, a predecessor people of the Rohirrim, after which there was a bit of a dispute between the Eothiod and the dwarves about who should have Scather's treasure, most of which he had taken from the dwarves, of course. It all ties into the main Lord of the Rings story because the Horn of the Mark was part of that treasure. A part of the Eothiod seemingly managed to keep hold of that, and it was passed down as an heirloom. Eowyn gives it to Merry towards the end of the story as a mark of his service to Rohan. Merry takes it back to the Shire with him, and that's the horn he uses to rouse the good Shire folk to fight against the ruffians in the scouring of the Shire. As is so often the case, there are layers here to this story that most readers simply wouldn't pick up on. But it's worth lingering on that description we had a moment ago of Scather. He was blind and silent, had icy breath, not fiery breath, and crawled rather than flew. It's a reminder that not all of Tolkien's dragons were like Smaug. Indeed, Scather sounds a lot more like Glaurung. Scather is described as a long worm, which is perhaps a subspecies of dragons for Tolkien, though he didn't make it clear. We also hear of fire drakes and cold drakes. You may have noticed that it was a cold drake that finally pushed the dwarves out of the Grey Mountains. Tolkien doesn't give us a full breakdown, but it's clear that there was a lot of variety. One thing we do know is that after Scather's death, the land had peace from the long worms, so perhaps he was the last of them. It's possible, though not certain, that during the height of Sauron's power in the Second Age, some or all of the dragons were under Sauron's control. There are a couple of hints that that may be the case, but it's not clear. But then we get Smaug, of course, who definitely wasn't under Sauron's control, though they were kindred spirits of an odd kind. You don't need me to tell you about his fate, but he came from the north and was very much a fire drake. He was also the greatest of the dragons of his day, with the hottest of flames. We know 4 rings of power were destroyed by dragons, but the One Ring could not apparently have been, because Gandalf says this to Frodo early on. It has been said that dragonfire could melt and consume the rings of power, but there is not now any dragon left on earth in which the old fire is hot enough, nor was there ever any dragon, not even Ancalagon the Black, who could have harmed the One Ring. Notice the language there. Gandalf doesn't say that there are no dragons left, but that there are no dragons left with hot enough fire. So Smaug wasn't the last dragon. Dragons were still alive and well during the time of the Lord of the Rings, presumably chilling out up on the withered heath. So what happened to them? There is no mention in the appendices to The Lord of the Rings or The Silmarillion, but thankfully Tolkien does address this in a letter to Naomi Mitchison, a proofreader for him. She had seemingly asked about dragons, given the importance of Smaug in The Hobbit, and whether they still existed. Tolkien replied, "Dragons. They had not stopped since they were active in far later times, close to our own. Have I said anything to suggest the final ending of dragons? If so, it should be altered. The only passage I can think of is Volume 1, page 70. There is not now any dragon left on earth in which the old fire is hot enough, but that implies, I think, that there are still dragons, if not of full primeval stature." The context here, of course, is that Tolkien was of the view that Middle-earth is our Earth, albeit in a different stage of imagination. So the tales of dragons that we have, feel free to imagine your own favourite ancient dragon story, a part of that same tradition that Tolkien's dragons are a part of. So, to Tolkien, there are dragons still alive now, albeit of an entirely different scale, physicality and ferocity. Remember, Tolkien's dragons weren't all of the winged kind, didn't all breathe fire and so on. There are plenty of modern-day dragons. We often talk about how the fourth age of Middle-earth is the dominion of man, and the magical or legendary or fantastical had faded. The orcs were killed or fled underground, the elves travelled west or faded, the dwarves dug deeper and so on. But the dragons, Tolkien would have us know, they survived and leaked into our own legends. Changed and diminished, perhaps, compared to the fearsome creatures they were in antiquity, but still dragons. Perhaps that's why they have such a place in so many different cultures' mythologies in so many different ways, because they lingered as relics of a different age, just on the edges of civilization, up there on the withered heath, ever lurking at the back of our minds and imaginations.
Did you know that I release a lot of my longer videos, such as my live streams, as sleep videos on a separate channel? 8 hours long with no adverts in the middle, just some calming sounds in the background. If that sounds interesting, please do check out In Deep Sleep, my channel devoted to it. If you'd like to see more Lord of the Rings videos, please click on the link on the left of your screen. Or if you'd like to support this channel, thank you. There's a link to my Patreon page on the right of your screen. That's all for this time. Thanks for watching. I'll see you again soon.